welcome back to what I believe is episode 130 of Stream Time Sports. I'm your host, Nick Meacham, and I'm thrilled to be joining you after a pretty frantic and incredible couple of days in the heart of New York in Manhattan at Sports Pro New York. Now, it was a great experience for me for a few reasons. One, because it was my first trip out of Jamaica since I've moved here over 4 months ago, which incidentally was very talked about as I had half a dozen different listeners reach out to me at the event and ask me about it. So thank you for those who did check in and see how I was doing. But secondly, the chance to catch up with a good chunk of the Sports Pro team, that was a really good experience after speaking to them on a computer for so long. But really the main reason out there that was so cool to get a bit closer to was really what's happening in the US sports media landscape. And we talk a lot about it, but you can never really get a good sense of things until you're on the ground. And newsflash, it's still pretty crazy times out there right across the entire space. Now, before I open that can of worms, today's episode is not going to be a deep dive into learnings about that market, but indeed, I'm going to be talking to one of the most vested and vocal figures in the US sports media landscape in FuboTV's David Gandler. This was live recorded on stage at the event, and now most listeners will be familiar with David and Fubo. He's been a regular on the podcast, and more recently, following the huge announcement of the joint venture between Warner Brothers Discovery, ESPN, and Fox Sports, he's been extremely vocal about his concerns on the project, to the point where Fubo has actually launched a lawsuit against the initiative in quite a wide-ranging affair covering the joint venture approach itself, as well as wider alleged anti-corruption behavior being acted by the stakeholders of the joint venture. Now, Fubo itself, its offering is really followed by many people in the industry. It's a virtual MVPD, over 1.6 million subscribers across North America, charging upwards of $80 US a month for the privilege. And it has something like 80% of the major league US sports rights available, largely courtesy of its 35 or so RSNs that it has on the platform and major partnerships with all the major broadcasters. But they believe they've been paying over the odds some time, and despite it being a premium offering, really aren't happy with the dynamic of the market currently. So look, there's a lot to unpack with what Fubo are doing, and indeed the whole US media and sports media landscape. But few better to speak with and to get more out of this system, out of this situation, than David himself. So without any further ado, it's time for me to hand over to me speaking to FuboTV's David Gandler live at Sports Pro New York 2024. Thanks very much, everyone. And I'm joined by David Gandler, who is the CEO and co-founder of FuboTV. Please sit down, David. Great to have you. Now, there is a lot to cover today, David, that's happening with you and indeed what's happening across our industry. So let's jump straight into it. Firstly, you had your recent earnings call, which was a chance for you to talk about the numbers for the previous financial year. Talk us through some of the top line numbers there that really stood out for you, that you know show that the trajectory you guys are on right now.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. It was a wonderful 2023. You know, we delivered almost 30% top line revenue growth. We delivered about 14% increase in ad revenue. Overall, subscribers hit another record number of 1.6 million. So I think it was a pretty remarkable 2023, given all the disruption that's happening in the space.
Some pretty good numbers. Top line growth, more efficiencies on the cost saving side. So all the things you'd want to see on your earnings call coming through for shareholders. Yet, when you announce those numbers, the share market doesn't always react the way you would expect.
I think it never reacts the way you expect when it comes to Fubo.
I think over the last couple of earnings calls, I've seen that similar reaction. Why do you think that? Do you have any idea or any sense as to why, I guess, the market reacts in such a way where you guys are above guidance almost every time?
Well, I think to be clear, we've exceeded guidance or expectations now 11 out of 12 quarters as a public company listed on the New York Stock Exchange. I don't know of any other media company that has come even close. You know, we've improved our adjusted EBITDA by $100 million in 2023 on a mere, when I say mere, relative to what some of these big companies are doing, but on about $1.2 billion of revenue. So if you think about some of the larger media companies that are doing 20, 30, 40, 50 billion, you know, sometimes I'm shocked why they're not doing as well as we are. So yes, it is shocking, but I think, you know, Fubo has really defied gravity for 9 years. And every year it's the same old story. Well, Amazon's coming out with Thursday Night Football. You're dead. YouTube's coming out with Sunday Ticket. You're dead. So no matter what we're doing, I think that the market has a hard time understanding, well, how can we ultimately survive? So I think really it comes down to whether or not people believe you're relevant. But, you know, over time, they run out of reasons to say but, and you end up being part, an integral part of the market.
One of the things you've been very clear about is your goal to be have positive cash flow for 2025.
Yep.
How's that tracking for you?
Well, I mean, clearly we're tracking, you know, as we had stated back in 2022. We continue to improve our cash flow seasonally, year over year, every single quarter. That has happened now for, I think, the last 6 quarters. We've also beat expectations on the bottom line. So far, we think we're very comfortable with our current plan.
So for a while now, we've seen the industry shift from a growth first strategy to a pragmatic growth strategy, let's call it. And you've clearly identified that across your approach with the business. Looking towards your plans for next year, some of the projections for me, I thought they were interesting. I want to get your take on them. The expectations on growth we're looking at, I think you're around 1.61 million subs this year.
For 2023.
Yeah, for 2023. And projecting to grow to somewhere between 1.67 and 1.68 million subs for next year. That growth isn't a huge number of growth in subscribers.
Right.
Why have you decided to, say, tone down the growth expectations on the sub side? Is the focus more now going to be on real cost efficiencies and just making sure the business is stable, or is there other concerns or headwinds that you're facing?
Well, last year, I think we started the year the same way. I think we had roughly forecasted about 5% growth and finished well in the double digits. So there's some element of conservatism in our numbers, just given, you know, every week there's some new piece of news out there that changes everything. And you know, again, we're one of few companies that continues to forecast, whether it's on advertising, whether it's on subscriber growth. You know, we feel very comfortable that we're able to deliver on the numbers that we have forecasted. And I think the other piece is, if you're going to hit cash flow break even, you know, you really have to focus on the revenue side, less the sub side, because subscriber models require a lot of money invested in the beginning, right? Because it's so you invest money today, and then there's an LTV over the long term. So obviously investing more into the front end will cost more initially. Personally, you know, I would do things slightly different, but as a public company, we have you know, to deal with shareholders, and we need to be fiscally responsible, and we have fiduciary responsibilities. So that's why we've been a little bit more conservative.
You talked about news in there. There's been a lot of news in the industry over the last few months. And one of the biggest stories that was a hit the 2024 Newswire was the announcement of the joint venture between Warner Brothers Discovery, Disney, and
Fox. You mean
Fox.
The sports cartel?
The sports cartel.
I am a thought leader.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about your initial reaction when you heard that. Was it a surprise?
I'm not surprised. This is just the latest example of a pattern of bad behavior that we've seen since we launched the business. Again, this is part of the reason why you said, well, how do you have so many great quarters? I mean, let me just break it down to you. I mean, since this is a sports conference, I'll use Moneyball as an example. When you apply Moneyball analysis to Fubo, what you'll find is that our revenue per employee in 2003 was $3.3 million. You can fact check that. To put that into perspective, Netflix, which is obviously a highly scaled business, is roughly 2.6 million of revenue. And Spotify, 1.8 million of revenue. And our friends over at Roku, 1 million. And just to give you a social media stat, you know, Snapchat's around $900,000. So it took us 7 years to get to 1 billion of revenue. It took Netflix 10 years to get to 1 billion of revenue. It took Spotify 7 years as well. So everything we're doing very well. So the question is, if you're so effective and so efficient and you have 11 straight quarters or 11 out of 12 quarters of exceeding expectations, and you've had the foresight in terms of feature sets like multi-view, and really focusing on sports as a way to really build your base, then you tell me, what's the problem? What can it be? And the answer is simple. It's that we're being overcharged, 30 to 50%. We're dealing with complexities around packaging. I'm not going to get into details of it because there's a lot of complexity there, but we're forced to take on content that we don't want in order to access must-have programming. When I say must-have programming, it means that 80% of the sports content that the CFO of Disney said that they would have at launch. And then there are other restrictions, right? We don't get to carry ESPN Plus, although we pay more per subscriber than anybody out there. So there are things like that, elements that I think are, have been unfair. And again, we're not, I'm sure some of the other executives will say, they're just crybabies. We're absolutely not crybabies. We're more than happy to take them on head to head, pound for pound. But, we're just looking for equitable terms. Again, would you be okay if, American Airlines, United Airlines, and, JetBlue or somebody decided to buy Boeing? How would we feel about that? Or if Citibank, JP Morgan, and Bank of America said, you know what? We're going to launch an online digital bank. So all we're saying is we want equitable terms. We're happy for consumers to have as much choice as they want. But for the last 7 years, we have provided consumers with a streaming service that was significantly more effective and efficient than cable. So we just want to continue that process, and we're happy to do that again on fair and equitable terms.
So you released the press release a few weeks back with regards to the fact that you have actually launched a lawsuit against the venture.
Yep.
You mentioned some of the reasons there, but why decide to take it to that extent, I suppose?
Well, I mean, you see the news yourself. Every week it's something new. They start with Plus services. That doesn't work. They call Verizon, they bundle it, with other services. That doesn't work. I mean, they basically are throwing everything at the wall and hoping something sticks. And, if you don't have any competitors, guess what? It's going to work. And so it was a clear opportunity for us to be able to communicate what we're actually dealing with. It was very difficult for us to go in and talk about each of these companies individually. But, when you aggregate 80% of sports, it makes it much, much easier discussion for us to have as to why there is clearly anti-competitive impact here.
So you've intimated, but just to be clear, in terms of the competitive nature of the platform itself, you talked about the conditions which you're currently under is the main issue, not necessarily the launch of the platform. What impact do you think?
I don't think we've ever said, I mean, look, we have, when we started this company, we were up against Sony PlayStation Vue, which, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, they complained to the DOJ back in 2014, and they're no longer here. So note to self. There was T-Mobile's Vision product, Amazon Thursday Night Football, Peacock, Paramount Plus. People still want to use an aggregated platform, and we've been very focused on ensuring. I mean, we talk about friction and fragmentation now for, since 2020. We've been the first to talk about the rebundling in our shareholder letter of March of 2021. So, from my perspective, this is sort of normal course, and you should be able to compete for customer eyeballs, compete for wallet, and we think that we're very well positioned to be able to do that.
Obviously, it's only days with regards to what that platform will actually be, of the core focus of what networks and coverage will be on there has been covered. You obviously talk about the breadth of sports rights on the platform, and you call yourself the sports first platform. So how competitive really do you think that platform itself will be with what you're offering at the moment? Or do you think there's enough complementary nature that someone would subscribe to both?
Well, this is part of our claim, right? The reason why we're so bothered by this, and I'm surprised everyone here, well, I'm not surprised because I think I'll never get a job in media again after this. But the problem here really is the consumer side of it. How many people have, at least four or five services to get the same experience you had 6 or 7 years ago? So it's gotten much more expensive, right? You can't find anything. And you find yourself, you know, I don't want to use any company examples here because I know that'll be used against me at some point. But, you know, the reality is, you know, they put one game on their service, push you into a quarterly or an annual plan, and now you end up paying for the same content sometimes twice, sometimes three times or more. And so when you sort of aggregate all of that cost, consumers are spending probably around $10 billion or so in excess fees to get the same content. It's just, it's immoral. It's not fair. And you know, we have an obligation to stand up for customers.
One of the quotes that's come out of the leadership group there has been the fact that there, I think it was Lachlan Murdoch who said it, that they believe, well, he believes they can get to 5 million subscribers in 5 years. What's your view on how achievable that is given, I guess, given your experiences so far?
Well, you know, when there's a lawsuit, you got to be careful what you say, so you don't want to make it sound too good to be true. So, you know, I would take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, again, there's so many examples. Look at Hulu SVOD, right? We all know the Hulu product. There has never been a competitor. That product is launched in 2008. Nobody has been able to build a service that can compete with it directly. You might be thinking Netflix or something else, but Netflix is 10 years older than Hulu. So, you know, my view is that what'll happen is they'll probably start with 3 and then use the same playbook and get to 4 and then 5. And so they want to do it as quietly as possible. And, you know, fortunately, there's someone like Fubo here to make sure at least that everyone can see the truth.
To look across the industry more widely, you talked about aggregation, and there's been a lot of activity on different types of partnerships and distribution deals happening. We're also seeing people like YouTube and indeed Amazon become much more of an aggregator than a single destination and bringing a lot of different partnerships in place. How do you see those types of platforms and those types of approaches? Are they in a similar sphere to what the joint venture approach is, or is that, in your view, a different ballgame?
Yeah, so we always get that question, or like, how similar are we to these other, you know, platforms? I would say, look, we're not an app store. We never claimed to be an app store. We wanted to create a unified experience where, you know, people can get all their favorite content in a very personalized way. I've been talking about this for many, you know, many, many years now. And so, you know, the way I look at it is very simple. If you went in through like an Amazon interface, and let's say you were a big Cristiano Ronaldo fan, making this up, only because the rights have been so divided. So today he plays in the Saudi League, which is on Fox, right? He may still play for Portugal, and that might be the Euro Cup. And so you have athletes that you might want to follow that are playing in different teams, different events, or have, you know, maybe they have, they're speaking on different networks. And how do you follow an athlete if you're constantly having to jump around from platform to platform? You're never actually going to get the value out of your service. So, you know, we consider ourselves to be a premium platform servicing customer needs, and we've been at the forefront of innovation now for a long time.
So your business, and indeed the other businesses we're talking about, are very much still built on a subscription first model.
Right.
What we're seeing a lot across the wider industry in other markets outside of the US is a real resilience or resistance perhaps from younger generation audiences to subscribe and put money up front for access to these things. They instead will use other platforms and other forms of entertainment instead is the fear and concern and particularly around non-live rights. You obviously have taken a hybrid approach in the monetization. Right. Do you see advertising becoming a continually bigger piece of the pie for access to particularly the live sports component of what you'll do, or do you think it will stay as a subscription model for the near to medium future?
Well, you know, when we took the company public, we really sort of talked to investors about the dual revenue stream of advertising and subscription. I mean, sports is just too expensive for it to just be advertising driven. So it's definitely going to be a hybrid. Of course, there will be, we have our own network called Fubo Sports Network that's available, I think 90 million plus homes at this point. And we do play some games on the free network just to kind of drive awareness for our partners. But it's highly unlikely you can sort of, you know, offer sports, you know, given the premium nature of different leagues, right? It also depends on the league, of course. But I think for the most part, it's going to be a dual revenue stream.
Across the industry globally, we have seen a downturn or a flattening of sports media rights value.
Right.
Do you think that's something that you're going to see more of in the US now as well? Obviously, a lot of deals have been locked in for a longer term. NBA, we're waiting for what the outcome there is on those rights as well. What's your view on the future of the premium prices that sports properties are charging for those rights?
Well, I think taking the NFL out of the equation, because I think those deals are through like mid or 2031, 2 and 3. So I think there's time for that one. But, you know, for the other ones, look, I mean, this is the United States. It's a very competitive market. And as you see from the irrational behavior over the last 3 years of many of the major players in the market, they don't care, right? It's about crushing everyone for the sake of crushing everyone, including themselves. So, you know, my view is that, you know, there's probably one or two more rounds of premiums being paid because these are sort of defining moments. One thing that I don't understand is why, you know, the Amazons of the world want to own sports rights. I just don't get it because they own the platform. So wouldn't you much rather have the NBA pay you a VIG, as we say in sports, and you're still aggregating everything? So when I look at that, that to me is a little bit of a head scratcher. So we'll have to see what happens there. But I think that for some of the traditional media companies, because they're forcing companies like Fubo to pay for unwanted content, I think like they have to continue to pay up, or you know, the writing's on the wall.
Right. In a few minutes, I will throw some questions to the floor. But just quickly, one of the things I saw you made a new deal with the MASN network, the Baltimore Orioles and Washington Network, Nationals home. That gives you something like, I think, 35 regional sports networks available on the platform.
Yep, that sounds right.
What role does the RSNs play on the platform? How important are they? Are they just one piece of many pieces of the puzzle for you in terms of attracting audiences, or are they more significant than that?
Yeah, well, look, I think we were the first ones. Well, we're always the first ones, but I think we've identified the RSNs as important components of our platform. If you look very closely at ratings, the reason why the RSNs never show up on any ratings reports is because ratings are national. So if you just look at ESPN, in any one market, you'll see that there's an RSN either very close to ESPN in that market, or you'll find that these RSNs are actually above in terms of viewership. And so we believe in the primacy of sports. Sports is local, which is one of the reasons why I think maybe you asked me before, like, oh, are you worried about Sunday Ticket? Does this change things for you around the NFL? And as you guys saw, we grew tremendously in the third quarter, despite the fact that the promos that YouTube was giving away were just insane. Like, only one company can do that. It's like Gmail. It can give anything away. And so, you know, from my perspective, it's the primacy of sports, and, you know, we want to cater to customers in a way that they want to, you know, consume content. And to me, most people are local fans, right? I think if you look at just Major League Baseball Pass or any of the other passes, those services have never grown more than a certain level. I'm not going to say what that level is. Not because they're not good or people don't want to watch it. It's just because if you live in Boston, you're going to be a Red Sox fan. I mean, that's just a fact. So
the value of sports, we've talked a little about, you don't see that really changing. You also have, I'm not sure how publicized it is, your international business as well, how much coverage it gets over in the US. But just talk about how that's tracking. You guys made an investment in Molotov, the French streaming platform out there.
Yeah, well, you know, I always go back to, we probably have the best management team. Again, I go back to Moneyball. You don't have to take my word for it. Do your own research. But, you know, we took over Molotov, which is a French streaming platform, number two to Canal Plus, for a couple of reasons. One is we wanted to understand how international works. We wanted to acquire a solid engineering team. It was a very similar product, less sports oriented, but very similar, linear. It's the aggregation of linear networks. And so, you know, we took it over. I think they were doing about 7 million of revenue. 2023, 31 million of revenue. Gross margins went from, just call it almost zero, to north of 35%, all in 24 months, with no marketing budget. And we've been able to drive subs from about, I think it was 80,000 to over 400,000. And we have over 1.2 million monthly active users. So what that allows us to do is, one, we've learned how to manage that, right? And number two is we're finishing up our unified platform. which allows us to do some really amazing things. It allows us to add freemium onto the platform. We've rebuilt our whole subscription platform. So, you know, obviously in all these markets, there's different ways that people pay for content. So we want to make sure that we have the APIs necessary or be able to accept the APIs that are out there to be able to really deliver these products very quickly. And the number of edge cases is reduced with every entry into every market. So again, we have a long-term view, and our plan is to make sure all the technology is ready. Obviously, just want to be clear, we're not doing anything internationally at the moment, but you know, we're gearing up for that at some point in time, post our free cash flow in 25. Because we do think that there's a whole world out there that we can create a great product for. And I think what's also interesting, particularly in Europe, is that the antitrust regulation is pretty damn strong. So it gives us a nice way in which that we can sort of enter markets and not have to worry about, as I said, some of the bad behavior that we're dealing with in the United States.
Before I look around the room for the question, just a quick question on Molotov then, in terms of specifically around sports. Do you see a move into the live sports in right side in a market like France, which is not particularly buoyant at the moment from a cost perspective around those premium rights?
Yeah, well, of course, that's the plan. Right now, the brand is Molotov by Fubo. As we start to move into sports, you know, we're having some conversations. We have the World Cup. We have a few other events on the platform, but you know, we'll look to sort of expand on that over time. But of course, we want to do it in a way that's fiscally responsible.
Right. Any questions from the audience? If I can see, put your hand up. That I will. There we go. We've got a question right at the front.
The first question: do you ever thought about creating organic content for Fubo? Your own content creation is a direction you want to go?
Yeah. So look, we have our own network right now. You know, we have some licensing deals currently, but I think that you know, I'm thinking about video more like Spotify. In music, where you can use the artificial intelligence that we've been also building out. Again, we were first to market with that in 2021. Did I say first again? I feel like I say that all the time.
I think you did.
I'm thinking more synthetic channels and being able to, you know, cater to your specific needs. Think of it as like Spotify has, like if you like rap music, there's a Rap Caviar, right? There's a station that you can access that kind of aggregates songs that the machine thinks, you know, are relevant for you. I think you'll see us start to do that in the coming years with sports talk, news programming. So I see us moving in that direction. We certainly want to differentiate from programmers. Like that's their job. Our job is to really create a super aggregation platform. So I think we'll probably stay in that space and focus on product.
Okay, another question?
Thank you. So you talked a lot about the Disney, Warner Bros. Right. Fox streaming bundle. But at the same time, you also talked about how like rights have been kind of too split up now. It's been very complicated for the consumer. Right. What do you think those companies should do instead, like given that the fact that they're suffering on the linear side and the streaming side? Like what would you propose?
Well, you know, I don't get paid to give other people advice. I've tried. That didn't work. What I would say is that, like I said, they're programmers. And if you think about the deterioration of the linear business, you have to say, why has it deteriorated, right? And the reason for that deterioration is because when you take content off of the, I'll call it the pay TV platform, I don't want to call it linear, and you're offering some of that content at below wholesale rates, you're driving people out of that ecosystem. And what I think has become clear to everyone, I hope it has, well, not to everyone. If you're on the 51st floor somewhere, probably not that obvious to you because it's still cloudy up there. But what I would say is that they need to really focus on, you know, programming, you know, the networks better, programming the content better, allowing us to provide better feature sets so that people are more engaged, which would drive sponsorship and advertising dollars for them as much as us. So, you know, basically this is what you've seen over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years is really a massive destruction of value that I haven't seen in any other industry. And all of this is due to basically just self-inflicted wounds and trying to find solutions for problems that probably don't exist, right? Who wants to have 50 platforms and go search and, you know, you're watching Thursday Night Football, there's a break, you want to quickly see another game or check out the news or do something, the weather, and that's it. You're trapped, right? So again, I think at some point in time, what you'll see is that I think as investors apply pressure on these companies, I think they'll start to become a little bit more rational and allow us to do the work that we're supposed to do and give them time to focus on programming.
So I have one question at the front here, Rob.
Can you hear? Yeah. You mentioned Moneyball a lot. I love that analogy. Yeah. It sounds like the fundamentals are strong. The long-term opportunity is massive. Why do you think Wall Street's missing this, and what do you think that you guys need to do to get them to care more and kind of fully value the company?
Yeah, good question. Look, when I say Moneyball, I mean not only the stats that I provided today, but if you think about it, we are probably the most expensive product in the market. And in 2020, I think we had about, don't quote me here, but fact check it, 500,000 or so subscribers to, I want to say, Hulu's 4 million or so. So we were roughly about 26 or 27% of Hulu's base in 2020. And today, fast forward, 37%. So better efficiencies across the board, higher prices, we're taking market share. You know, there's really is only one reason why investors have a hard time. And the answer is they don't believe that we can sustain the pressure applied, you know, from these companies. And so that's why I've been so vocal about it on our earnings call on Friday, because, you know, at some point, it's like a teenager spinning out of control. Like they tried everything. So this was just an opportunity for us to speak about something that I think not only impacts us, but impacts consumers. I mean, forget about all the junk fees. We're talking about $10 billion of fees that most of you are paying here. That is just unfair. I'm sure, you know, when you're at home talking to your parents or your spouse or your kids, and you look at your bills, you're like, what is this? Like a few hundred bucks? You don't even know when programming is on. So, you know, my view is like we just had no choice. They put us in a box, and you know, I've told them for many years, you know, if you want to, this goes for everyone in this room. When you negotiate with someone, you want to negotiate with them in a way that, you know, for instance, if you're negotiating with us, you don't want to push us over the ledge. You want to keep us on the ledge, but you want us to continue to engage with you and pay the premiums. But when you push someone over the edge, they have no choice. They're going to fight you. So when I say that this is a real fight, you know, and by the way, we haven't lost a fight. Now, I'm not saying we're going to win this one, but we haven't lost one yet. And, you know, I feel pretty good about our chances, just given the very simple things that we've laid out for you. And again, it all comes back to consumers.
Unfortunately, that is all we've got time for today. Thank you so much, David, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Before you go, myself and Nick would just like to thank you for tuning into this episode of Stream Time. If you found the episode insightful, please make sure you like and subscribe on whichever platform you listen to. As a growing podcast, we'd greatly appreciate your support in sharing or writing a review. Ultimately, we want this podcast to not only entertain you, but also hopefully help you navigate the digital sports landscape. If you have any feedback on previous episodes or any topics and speakers you'd like to hear from in the future, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can find myself and Nick Meacham on LinkedIn or on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SportsProChris1. Nick can be found @SportsProNick. Of course, if you want to stay fully up to date on the sports business news cycle, please make sure to visit the Sports Pro Media website or sign up to one of our several newsletters to make sure you don't miss anything. Once again, thank you, and we look forward to you joining us next week on the Streamtime Podcast.